Plot twists. We are obsessed with them. In film, life, and love, they turn up everywhere. It's that moment in a story that takes you in an unexpected direction. I'm Tom, super fan of cinema, sport, comedy, and I'm partial to The Odd Impression. And throughout this series, brought to you by Now and Sky, I'll be interviewing TV and film stars, asking them all about the plot twist moments that define their lives and careers. So expect the unexpected, and hopefully some behind-the-scenes gems you've never heard before. Expect spoilers. Hey everyone, it's another week, it's another comedian, and it's another trip for us to Brighton. Love it. Maisie Adam is our guest this week. I'm a big, big fan of her. She honestly catapulted herself onto the comedy scene, winning So You Think You're Funny. It's the Edinburgh Fringe stand-up show for newcomers, and she hasn't looked back since, and she's just gone on to new heights. You'll know her for her haircut, you'll know her for being a hilarious stand-up, and she's known for her love of football. She's a big Leeds United fan. You would have seen her on Fantasy Football with Matt Lucas and Ellis James. And she's now on a new A League of Their Own special with Catherine Ryan and new team captain Jill Scott. It's going to be a blast. They're spending time with the Lionesses, looking ahead to the World Cup. I can't wait for that. The Euros was such a great atmosphere. And I really think England could do it. I think they're going to win it. So that's going to be fun. It's a great show. Go and check it out. Available on Sky Max. And now, back to Maisie. There is so much to talk about. Only last month, she got married. She's then playing soccer aid the next day. What a weekend that would have been. And in typical Tom fashion, I found a few bits of information. I thought, I'll use that to my advantage, build a bit of rapport. So here it is, the brilliant and hilarious Maisie Adam on Plot Twist. Now, I thought a good podcast episode.
Yeah.
A one-on-one podcast interview like this.
Yeah.
Building rapport initially is key.
Absolutely.
That is the secret. It's not even the secret because I'm telling you and I'm telling our listeners.
It's an open
but it's
secret.
The key.
Yeah.
It's the key to success. Now, I could find some trivia about you and you could think, oh my gosh, this guy is, he's put in the work.
Yeah.
Or I could bribe you.
Oh. What would you bribe me with?
Chocolate orange.
Oh, he's done his research.
I've done my research.
He's done his research.
I've got a gift.
This is a chocolate orange I've not seen before.
Which I was quite pleased about.
Yeah, it's not your classic Terry's.
I do have Terry's in the bag as well.
Oh, he's got a backup.
I had a backup.
Chocolate ganache.
Not sure about that?
I'm not sure. Do you know what it is? It's that thing where it's like, when people buy you chocolates and they get you those really posh ones that are like mixed white and dark, and you think, oh, just get me a Dairy Milk. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's what...
You're overcomplicating it. But he's prepared. He knew I would say that. You see that?
See, that's the
that's
golden
the dream.
Ticket.
Ask me anything you want and I will tell you for that. Genuinely. I will sell my soul to the devil for that. If I've had a bad day, if I've had a stressful day, there is nothing that and a cup of tea...
Could pick me up.
...cannot solve. Who needs therapy when you've got Terry's chocolate orange?
It's good.
I think a lot of therapists would say you.
Yeah.
But I've got Terry's chocolate orange. Terry's my therapist.
I was thinking, as a kid, I didn't like chocolate.
You didn't like any chocolate?
Any chocolate.
That's a red flag.
It is.
That's a weird...
It's a weird red flag.
That's a sort of, we need to talk about Kevin trait, I think.
Yeah. It's like at Easter, I used to get...
Don't say fruit.
No, I got mini cheddars.
Oh, what? Yeah, I'd be like, I don't want to go and play out with him.
32 and single. For the reason.
But do you have chocolate now?
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Right, yeah.
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 I've seen the error of my ways.
You've moved away from the mini cheddar obsession.
Yeah. I should say congratulations.
For...
You married last month.
For being the world's biggest fan of chocolate orange. Yeah, I got married a month ago. We both completely missed our 1 month anniversary, just completely forgot. We were like, oh,
settled
that was yesterday.
Life.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing. It was here in Brighton. Oh, it's so cliche, isn't it? People go, it's the best day of your life. Which
the best weekend.
Yeah.
For you.
I mean, it was the best weekend.
Ever.
It was the best weekend ever.
I don't know how you could ever really top that.
It was the perfect weekend for me. If I was asked to describe my dream weekend years ago, it would be marry the love of your life and then immediately go and play a like world-class football match with some of the biggest stars of the game.
At the Theatre of Dreams.
I mean,
not
a Leeds
for you.
Fan, so to honeymoon at Old Trafford was,
well,
it was a compromise,
a
really.
Give and take.
Yeah, if they'd have said Wembley, that would have been 10 out of 10. So it was a 9 out of 10 weekend, I suppose, because I had to go to the Theatre of Dreams. But it was amazing. It was amazing. Absolutely loved it. And I remember, like, when I got offered it, because I've wanted to do Soccer Aid for years. I mean, I watched it as a kid, always loved it. And then as I started to be in comedy and people knew that I like my football and I'm a comedian, like, I thought, oh, that'd be great if I could do Soccer Aid. And I've wanted to do it over and over again. And then finally, when I did get asked, they said the date. And you know when, like, a date goes in your head?
That,
I was like,
that rings a bell.
11th of June. What am I doing 11th of June? I was like, there's nothing in the diary. Went to the day before. Oh, that's when we've booked the wedding for. So I was sort of a bit like, oh, God. And what was like, I said to Mike, I was like, I've been offered Soccer Aid, but it's the day after the wedding. And there was like no even hesitancy of like, oh, how will we make it? He was like, incredible. Like, let's do it. It'll be an amazing thing to do the day after. So that was great. But I was still a little bit like, yeah, but do you want to do it hungover? You know, it's the first time they've had women who were not former pros or joined football in any professional capacity. So I was a bit nervous about it. And then I told two of the girls from my football team, I was like, you can't tell anyone, but I've been offered Soccer Aid. And they're both married and with kids. And they were like, honestly, do it. The day after your wedding is such a come down. All you do is just sit there sort of like, oh, everyone's gone home now. And we're just left with all this shit in our flat or whatever. Like, it's lovely, but you've got all these gifts and you've got to work through them and sort of come down from it, really. Whereas we just sort of ran straight through on the adrenaline of it. It was great. Like, I mean, we were so hungover the next morning. Like, Mike didn't take his sunglasses off, I think, until he was at Old Trafford. And then, of course, I turned up thinking, you know, I'll be on for the last 10 minutes, which is when most of the celebrities go on. And Pochettino was our manager, which is I would never, ever have thought I'd hear myself say. I cannot believe I'm sat here on a podcast saying, and Pochettino, who was our manager, Pochettino and Sporty Spice had decided between them, Pochettino, Sporty Spice and Martin Compston from Line of Duty had decided between them that I should be on the starting 11. And I thought that was a joke. I turned up after this 3-hour drive up to Manchester the morning after my wedding, feeling a little bit worse for wear. And they were like, yeah, you're starting. I was like, are you joking? And I think I was playing on the right... Well, I like to play on the right wing, but on the left wing, sort of working in conjunction with me, was Usain Bolt. And so it's like, that's such an impossible task on any day when I feel 100%, but I'm hanging out my ass. I've done a 3-hour journey where I've just been asleep and occasionally waking up to try and stomach some Diet Coke. And now I'm going to play in front of a sold-out Old Trafford. I was marking Gary Cahill and was playing in front of Roberto Carlos. I remember he was sort of behind
that
me.
That is mental.
Heather O'Reilly, who's won a Women's World Cup. And, yeah, it was insane. I remember, like, Mike texted me whilst I was playing, but he was like, we've just heard on the commentary, there was a bit where it said, Hernan Crespo to Adam to Totti. Like, you know, you just think, like, there's no way that sentence, if you'd have told me as a 12-year-old, oh, yeah, one day you'll be playing.
Is it about Charlie Adam? No, Maisie.
Yeah. Like, what?
That is cool.
Absolutely insane. So, yes, it was the best weekend ever.
Could you have ever envisaged that? I mean, because you're known for being a football fan. And...
Yeah. And, like, that's sort of the extent of it. You know, you're a fan. You watch it from the sides and you comment on it and you say what you'd do. And then suddenly they go, well, what would you do? Get on the pitch. I have to say that after Soccer Aid, like, I, having gone to countless football games over the years, I will really think twice before shouting advice at the players again, because you can't hear anything. You cannot hear a word when you're on that pitch. I remember looking round and Heather O'Reilly was sort of shouting instructions and I was like, I can't hear you. You're so far away because this pitch is huge.
Yeah, you wouldn't even think of that, would you?
And Poch is there waving his up. Poch is waving his arms around and you're like, I'm just going to assume you're saying, keep running. I don't know. So yeah, it was mad and it's something you never, ever think would happen to you. Like, I can remember having my mates around to watch it in my bedroom as a teenager.
Yeah. What a weekend.
Yeah.
That is extraordinary. Should we ask a plot twist question?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's go on the first one. So it's the main plot twist for you and your story, something that can change narrative and change your direction and have perhaps the biggest impact. Is there a particular plot twist that stands out?
Yeah, there's loads.
I mean, you just said Roberta Carlos was playing behind me and I'm still getting over that.
Yeah, it's pretty mad. It's pretty mad. I think if we're talking about how I've ended up sort of being a comedian, one thing that I'd sort of have to sort of mention is when you become a comedian, a lot of people talk about like the steps that you do, like you start out in a certain style of way, and that definitely wasn't the case for me. So I did.
You kind of shot straight in, right?
Yeah, and I think that's been really helpful for me. So I did a drama degree at a drama school, and I guess that would be the first plot twist is I was really lucky at secondary school to have a drama teacher who's one of those teachers that you hear people talk about where they really do change the course of your path. Like,
is this Mrs. Bray?
Yeah, Mrs. Bray. She was absolutely brilliant. She was one of those teachers that just like lived and breathed drama. And she looked at pupils individually of what they needed as opposed to what is sort of the path
the
of
collective
success. Yeah, the done way. And I have to say, like, I loved my time at school, but it was definitely an environment where it was like you go to school and you go to the sixth form and then you go to a university. And Mrs. Bray was really, like, very good. So she took me aside and was like, you should go to a drama school, not a university, because I'm not particularly academic in terms of what's required for a degree. She said if you went and did a drama degree at a uni, you'd end up doing a lot of written work of thesis and, you know, like dissertations and stuff like that. Whereas at drama school, it's a very practical training. And I had no idea about drama schools. Drama schools for me was like the film Fame, of like people doing high kicks in a corridor and directors sort of in berets smoking inside. And I don't know, like very sort of American idea of what a drama school was.
It's funny how we get these pictures.
Yeah. And I had no idea. And also I thought all drama schools were like musical theatre thing. And I don't sing or dance or anything. I just really liked being in plays. And even at that point, actually, it's probably worth saying that I would always be cast in like the funny roles. I liked making people laugh. I liked the immediate reaction you got. Mm. And so I applied for these drama schools, of which there was about 12, and they all cost a bomb even to just bloody audition for. Didn't get into any. So stayed behind, like stayed at home for a year, did a gap year. Well, I say a gap year. Gap years always like evoke pictures of sort of go backpacking around Thailand, don't they? But it was working in Fat Face for a year, saving up money.
Were you still set on the goal and still very...
Yeah. I just thought, and there was a lot of people going, very few people get into drama school at 18. They want you to have a bit of life experience, but I don't think working at Fat Face for a year gave me a load of life experience. But anyway, I then auditioned again the second year and got into a couple and had to make a choice and ended up doing this drama degree at a drama school. Loved the first year, found the second year sort of a mixed bag, and by the third year, absolutely was crawling at the like walls to get out, because I sort of realised that acting is, like, I take my hat off to anybody that pursues that profession, because it's so dependent on other people. And this is what I found myself so frustrated with was
in terms of knowing people in the industry and
but even just like, so you're if you think about it, it's incredibly hard to even get through the door unless you have an agent. Mm. And then once you get an agent, they're putting you up for these roles of which, you know, you don't walk straight in and go for a role of Romeo in Romeo and Juliet. You're being put in for an audition for person in the background of a McDonald's advert, or do you know what I mean? Or person sat at the bus stop. Yeah. In an episode of Midsummer Murders. So there's a lot of stuff where you're like, well, it'd be great to get, but it's not exactly what I'm passionate about. And then even if let's say you did get cast as a main role in this theatre production, the director might be naff, or the script might be naff, or you might pull all your weight, but the other cast members don't. And I used to get really frustrated with that at drama school, of like group projects, if like you would really apply yourself and then some people just, and there's egos. It was full of egos, full of really nice people. I've got some mates still from the time, but also full of, it's essentially you're put into a class of every kid that was the main role in the school plays as kids, and every kid that likes being the main centre of attention, and you're putting them into classes of 20.
It's a lot of energy.
It is a lot of energy. And by the end, I was sort of desperate to get out, and I wasn't really convinced that acting is what I wanted to do. I was going up for jobs that I didn't really want, but I knew I liked being on stage. I knew I liked performing. I knew I liked creative output. And so I'd always liked the idea of doing stand-up, but again, never thought I would. But when I used to work at Fat Face, like if it was a bit quiet and I was on menswear on my own up on the first floor, I used to like have these little ideas, and I'd print out the till roll and write these little like routine ideas.
For a stand-up gig?
Never do anything with them. Like just used to write as if I was going to say it and then never would. And I'm talking like I would write them in 20... I didn't do my first gig till 2016 after uni, but I was working at Fat Face from 2010. So I'd been writing them for years.
Building them up.
And putting them in this little tin on my desk. It's so sad, and doing nothing with them. And I'd come out of drama school. I wasn't getting any work really. I was living back home with my mum and dad up in Yorkshire. And I was kind of working temp jobs at pubs, bars and burger vans, like... I used to live on the same road as this fella who like had all the contracts for like those bars that like, it's so Yorkshire, but like basically at the Yorkshire show, there'd be like the big remote Pimm's bar. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or like serving black sheep from a truck in a field, basically all of those. And I was doing all of that. And I think just out of pure desperation to have some creative output, I decided to give it a go. I was like, I'm going to do stand-up. And I started looking at where I could do it. Now, I live, at the time, I'm from a small village in North Yorkshire called Panel. It's not exactly a stand-up scene nearby. Nearest cities are Leeds and there's Harrogate town, but there's no circuit there. There's gigs in Leeds, but there wasn't really an open mic circuit. There was, you know, you could go and watch a comedy gig, but you couldn't be on it.
Mm.
So I was like, what do you do if you want to give it a go? And then there's a very small town called Ilkley near where I live. It had the Ilkley Literature Festival, which is a book festival, quite highbrow. Like they'd have sort of, you know, Richard Osman coming to talk about his crime books. But on this occasion, it was like, we're doing the literary festival, but I guess it's part of a funding thing. You've got to support local artists maybe. But they did a call out for local artists as part of their Fringe Festival. They were like, come and perform something. You can do dance, ballet, you can do spoken word, you can do music, you can do anything.
I'm picturing like Vicar of Dibley.
Yeah, yeah, proper Vicar of Dibley vibes in essentially a venue like, you know, Village Hall type thing. I mean, they've got a beautiful playhouse there, which is a little theatre. And so I responded to this call out and put my name, address, contact number, and then it was like, and what would you do? I said, I'd like to do stand-up comedy. You know, I didn't write any of my jokes down, but I said, like, I think I made up some sort of blurb being like, oh, funny and charming, Maisie Adam, local comedian, whatever. I'd never gigged in my life. Got a response and they were like, yep, here's your slot. And it was Thursday, 13th of October, 2016, 8 till 9 p.m.
You had an hour?
It was an hour.
You had an hour?
And I didn't think that was strange because I'd never done the open mic circuit. I'd never been to an open mic gig. So this is the plot twist, is I got that back and was like, great, I've got my first gig. But I didn't think an hour was strange because when I'd gone and
watched... Didn't know any different.
Yeah, if Jimmy Carr came and did Leeds on tour, I would go with my mates and he'd be doing probably 40 minutes break and then an hour and a bit.
Mm.
So I didn't think that was weird at all. All of my like DVDs, I had so many comedy DVDs. I used to ask every Christmas for like Lee Evans, Peter Kay, Lee Matt, all of these, Victoria Wood. They're all over an hour long. You'd be fuming if they only did an hour. So I thought it was really normal. I was like, yeah, great. And I had this tin of jokes where I was like, well, that's if I'd just sort of restructure them round, and which is what I did. I got them all out and sort of tried to connect them into some sort of thing. Memorised it, which I was pretty decent at memorising because of drama school and being in plays. It's like, you know, remembering lines. And I made all these flyers and I put them up round all the cafes in Leeds and Harrogate, and it was free. You didn't even have to pay to come. I even asked Mrs. Bray if I could come and hand them out at school, like to the drama kids. And she was like, yeah, absolutely.
Good old Mrs. Bray.
And I did this gig, and it was full, to be fair. I think mainly of people who thought, I can't believe, like people who knew me, who were like, I can't believe she's been so stupid as to attempt an hour of comedy. And my friend Katie, her dad had a camera sort of like these, and I was like, oh, would you mind filming it so I can, you know, which he did. And I did this gig. I mean, honestly, if I watched it back now, I've got the DVD somewhere. I don't think it'll ever see the light of day if I've got any control over that. It's probably a good 10 stretched over 50 or 55 minutes. But I did it, and it felt at the time like it went really well. Euphoric is the word. Like, such a buzz after it. Like, I've never been so scared to do something. But also, the moment I walked off stage and you can hear a room full of people applauding jokes you've written and delivered, it was so different to any, even a play that I'd ever been in, which I really look, like, if I think about the favourite role I'd ever played, it was the funny part in a really good play that was really well received and I was really proud. But this was like as if you'd written the play and performed it. Yeah. Like, it's a very selfish comedian thing to be like, but it's all you. Like,
well,
and
that was my
that's
thought
what
when
I
you were
love
telling
about
me.
Comedy.
Like, it doesn't feel like there was a, you know, you had Mrs. Bray kind of as an encouragement, yeah, but actually it was you as a creative master kind, yeah, of driving it.
Yeah, and that's what I love about comedy, is that there's no sort of scapegoating. Like, if a gig goes bad, you get, like, even now, you know, comedians will go, oh, the crowd was too pissed, or they weren't my crowd, or they're a bit this way or that way. At the end of the day, most of the control's in your hands. And so if your jokes don't land, you can kind of only really blame yourself. Mm. It's either the joke doesn't work or you delivered it badly. But if it goes brilliantly, it's like, God, they're laughing at something you've created and performed. And that feels so incredible. Mm. And I, like, if you think about, if you've ever told a story at the pub and people are absolutely creasing at it, that feels lovely. Yeah. I love making people laugh. I always,
it's always
have.
A good go-to.
I've always liked making my mates laugh. But if, when you can make strangers laugh, it's a different kind of buzz. And I got it straight away after this first gig. And I just remember walking off stage thinking, I just want to do that again and again and again and again and again. And I took that footage and like sent it to all these promoters, mainly who were like open mic bookers on the London and Manchester circuits.
You were really on the front foot.
And they'd be like, oh, you know, can I do your gig? And they go, yeah, have you got five? Have you got 5 minutes? I'd be like, I've got an hour, mate. I've got an hour. I'd be able to bloody WeTransfer them because it'd be too big to send in an email. But a lot of bookers on the open mic circuit saw that I had an hour and they were like, well, she must be all right. So they booked me. So I would work Monday to Friday and then get the mega bus down to London, because you could go over to Manchester, but there'd be like one, maybe two gigs you could do in a night. I could go to London and do like four open mics in a night. So I used to get the I used to get the megabus down after work on a Friday, and I stayed in this hostel in Camden that was £12 a night. And I would book myself to do gig after gig after gig on the Friday and Saturday nights and then come back on the Sunday. And I learned so much. And also I was always like, why do they only ever want you for 5 minutes? It's so weird that everyone's doing five. But I didn't realise that
that's how it is.
That's how it is. And really quickly, I then started doing tens. And then somebody said, or fives or tens. I don't really remember a progressive, but somebody at a gig went, you're pretty good. What you should do is apply for one of these newcomer competitions. And I did. I did So You Think You're Funny, to sort of gauge where I was at, you know, comedy level wise.
How far in were you from that first gig then, at that point, where you do So You Think
You're Funny? So my first gig was October 2016. I had my heat for So You Think You're Funny in May 2017.
Okay, so what, 6-7 months?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that long.
No, and I did that, and they don't tell you on the night when you do your heat, they don't tell you how you've done. So again, I think it was 7 minutes, I think is what they ask you to do. And it was at one of these open mic venues in London. Did that.
Was
and
this
then,
like almost, if you get through, you get through to then...
You get through to a semi-final at Edinburgh. Right. Yeah, so I did my 7 minutes, was like, great, you know. And then I was working in the remote bar. I was serving Pimm's in Millennium Square in Leeds as people were sat watching Wimbledon. And I was working in this like truck that had PIMS, and I was sort of, it was a bit quiet, and I could feel my phone buzzing in my pocket. So I sort of discreetly answered it, and they were like, "Oh, so you think you're funny? You're in the semi-final." And I was absolutely elated. I thought, God, if I can just say semi-final, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Did this, went up to Edinburgh.
Because that adds kudos in terms of your applications, right?
Yeah, massively. So went up to Edinburgh at the start of the month, was only in Edinburgh for 24 hours for the gig because it was all I could get off work. At that one, they tell you, like, oh, you've won the semi-final. So then I knew I was in the final. Went back to the final at the end of August. I was so convinced I hadn't won it. There was somebody who, it's a bit of a dickhead. I feel a bit of a dickhead if I say their name and then be like, oh, I was convinced they'd won. But there was somebody in my heat that I thought was so excellent. And they're,
you get a vibe, right?
Yeah, they're fantastic. And they're a brilliant gigging comic now, but I was so convinced that they'd won. And then when they said my name, I was like, oh my God. And that sort of definitely changed everything, was winning that, because I got signed off the back of it. The prize was £2,500, which was more money than I'd ever had, like ever. So I can remember cycling back through the streets of Edinburgh at like 3 a.m.
Oh, what a feeling.
Back to this flat. A friend from sixth form was at uni at Edinburgh doing an MA, and I was allowed to sleep on their sofa. And I was cycling back. I'd taken my bike up there, which was a mistake because it's such a hilly city.
It really is.
But I'd stayed at the after party and I was a bit pissed. And I was cycling back through the streets of Edinburgh with a cheque for £2,500 in my pocket, just being like, I can't believe you just won that amount of money for doing comedy.
You must have been so proud of yourself.
Like, it was an unreal feeling. And I kind of felt even then that was a bit of a plot twist moment of like, oh, this could change stuff.
It feels like one of those precious moments in life where you can, just for that short period of time, you can bask in the moment.
Yeah, 100%.
And you can get lost a little bit in the possibilities that might come from it.
Yeah,
you can just
absolutely
enjoy the present.
Absolutely. And also, like, as soon as I was announced as the winner, it's great, but it's a bit of a blur. And there's loads of people just coming up to you all night going, congratulations, and shaking your hand, and then giving you a business card, going, let's have a chat. You know, we represent comedians, let's have a chat. And it's very, like, overwhelming.
And you actually, just thinking, you hadn't been doing it for a year.
No, I've been doing it since...
Like 10 months?
Yeah.
That is mental.
Yeah, it was mad.
Talk about fast track.
Yeah, yeah, it was... And people kept saying that. They were, you know, these agents coming up to me going, less than a year. So it's quite overwhelming, and it's in a really hot venue. So suddenly cycling in the cool air, just on your own and having those thoughts to yourself, and as you say, just being able to actually take it in and bask and kind of... Yeah, it was the first time I'd really allowed myself to go... Well done.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
All those megabuses maybe paid off. And yeah.
But also the fact that you came from like a drama background, because even I was being Kerry Godliman.
Yeah.
And that felt a bit more unusual. But actually helpful in that you kind of were able to build a bit of a stage presence.
Yeah, massively helpful in terms of like, you know, I think the open mic circuit is probably the best training, but it helped that I went into the open mic circuit at least. You know, you see a lot of the sort of textbook rookie early errors on the open mic circuit of people who don't know how to stand on set. You know, they're fidgeting around
I'd be that.
You know, holding a sort of microphone like this and then moving away and telling a joke over there because you forgot. You know, like, if you've ever been to a wedding and watched a best man who's doing a best man speech and they've never held a mic before and they start sort of talking and they've told a punchline off mic and you're like, oh, we didn't hear that, mate. Like, there's all of those little things that maybe... you do pick up from doing a drama school.
But a collective groan.
Yeah.
I find it weird how comedians can be so different in terms of approaching a gig. Like Ross Noble will literally have no material. He'll just go off on wherever his, you know, his conversation, you know, wherever he feels. Whereas some people like to be very scripted and, you know, hell of a lot of prep into the wording and the, you know, the timing.
It's
and it's a real variation.
Yeah. You get some that just literally... That arrive at the venue 3 minutes before and they're like, yeah, all good. And they're so relaxed and then they just go out. And then there's like, I emceed a gig the other night where John Robbins was on doing a 20 and it's like, he's won countless awards. He's a very decorated comic, very capable. And like right before, he's there with a big wad of A4 paper going over it. And you're like, you know, I almost thought he was doing new stuff the way he was sort of reminding himself. And then he went out and I was like, oh, no, that is a polished routine. He just likes to go over and double check it all. It's mad.
It's funny because like behind the scenes, like seeing that, because when you see him on stage, you just think, wow, yeah.
it's just all effortless. And yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I love it.
I mentioned Kerry Godleman, and she was talking about women in comedy and mm-hmm. spoke about people like Victoria Wood, but actually the opportunities for women in comedy were, there were challenges. And in more recent times, that has got a lot better.
Yeah.
And we were saying that isn't just really applying to comedy, it's kind of across the board.
Yeah.
And even something like football, for example. You've got your new show, Catherine Ryan.
Yeah.
Jill Scott.
Yeah.
A League of Their Own special.
Yeah.
That must have been pretty fun again, to do. But amazing also that there is a special now, and there is this focus on the lionesses.
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, I always feel quite conflicted about these sorts of like areas. And you can kind of, I don't want to speak for them, but you can tell that like the lionesses, I suspect, feel the same of like, you have to acknowledge that it hasn't always been a level playing field. You have to acknowledge that, you know, historically comedy and football have both been very male dominated spaces. And it must have been really hard for the people that have gone before. And it's going to be so hard to not come across like I'm comparing myself to the current lionesses. But all I mean is that I see the lionesses and a lot of people in the women's game get asked questions that I get asked as well of like, what's it like being a woman in comedy? What's it like? Do you feel that, you know, it's coming along so well now? It really feels like this is a really good time for women in insert football or comedy. And that, I'd be lying if I said that didn't get quite jarring. There's a lot of times where like I'll be doing an interview and the first question is, what's it like being a woman in comedy? And I really just want to say it's like being any other comedian, but you get asked that question all the time because it's really frustrating. And I find that comedy is a meritocracy. Like you're good if you're good. Like if I go up to do a gig and I smash it and a bloke goes up to do a gig and he dies on his ass, I'll be the one that gets booked again. Now, I'm not saying that's always been the case. I'm no doubt that historically that would have been that, you know, people like Victoria Wood, when she was doing the circuit, would have had to maybe work twice as hard as some blokes who, you know, they're pally with the booker because they all drink in the same, I don't know, social club together. I don't know. And that, you know, you look at line, when I go to the Edinburgh Fringe, a lot of the venues have old posters up on the walls. And it is just like my dad in 12 different fonts. It's just it's just blokes everywhere. And occasionally, Joe Brand or bloke, Jenny Eclair, bloke, Victoria. It's insane. Whereas now, to be honest, now if you book a lineup and it's that sort of dad in 12 fonts pitch, it's a bit embarrassing on your part. Mm. One came up the other day on an email list I'm signed up to, and the lineup was just three very good comics, but three blokes all giving the same experience and perspective. And that's naff. That shouldn't be happening. There's so much diverse talent in all the different types of diversity. There's so much. There's no excuse for having all straight white men lineups. So, and I've never found it. And I've been on the circuit for 6 years now. And I completely acknowledge that people like Kerry and people that came before Kerry will have had perhaps much more difficult experiences with being the one woman on the lineup. I often am still on the club circuit, the only one woman on the lineup. I'm very rarely the one woman on a lineup on telly now because they're held to much better standards in terms of diversity. But I've never found it a struggle to get gigs, if I'm being honest. And I've never found it as a struggle as a woman at gigs. Certainly the more professional it's got. The open mic circuit is the most rogue for that sort of thing in terms of people who run a gig and say, yeah, and accommodation's included, and then you inquire what the accommodation is and it's their sofa. And you're like, yeah, but I don't...
Really?
Yeah, yeah. That sort of thing happens loads on the open mic circuit, which is horrible. And there's people who run it with bad intentions and stuff like that. And I would say that sometimes the only thing that you think about that perhaps as a male comic you don't is... I can remember when I first started getting booked on the circuit for paid professional gigs, and you'd look on Google Maps for the walk home to the station and check that it's on a main road, that you're not having to walk across a path, anything like that. I'd say that's the only difference I've experienced that perhaps a man
I mean, that's a broader doesn't. Thing, I suppose.
But that's it. Yeah, this is my point exactly, is they go, that's not the experience of being a female comedian. That's the experience of being a woman. Mm. Like, you would check your walk home for lots of things. You would wear your headphones in but not play music walking home from drinks with the girls to the bus stop. I was doing that before I was doing... That's just being a woman. That's not being a female comedian. My experience as a female comedian has been, I would say, much the same as many of my male contemporaries.
As it should be.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you bring up football, because I can tell that with the fantastic turning point that it feels that the women's game is at now, where it's finally being given this platform and respect and that, profile that
that's
it deserves.
It exactly, though. It's been given a platform.
That's it.
Whereas 10
it's
years
always
ago,
been there.
It's always been there.
It's always been there, but it hasn't been given the platform or respect or profile that it deserves. And so I sometimes wonder, do the likes of Leah Williamson, Millie Bright, Beth Mead, do they get quite tired of being asked about, what do you think about the state of the women's game now? Because it's this really because it is, but at the same time, they must be desperate to just not be seen as women footballers and be seen as footballers.
Mm.
Because like how I say, my experience, you know, I'm telling jokes on set, they're playing football on a pitch. Why does it need to be compared in this sort of women's sphere? So I always feel that's why I always struggle to not, I'd be a real prick to turn around to people and go, oh, what's it like being a female comedian? It's like being a normal comedian, but you get asked that question more. Because I understand why the question is asked, as I'm sure, you know, the lionesses understand why those questions are asked for that. Like I acknowledge, you know, Kerry, Jenny Eclair, before that Victoria Wood, you know, really far back. Beth Mead will acknowledge the likes of Alex Scott and the likes of, even going back further to sort of Dick Kerr ladies in the time where it was women's football was banned. All of those journeys and experience that have made the game or the comedy circuit where it is today. You can acknowledge it, but you're also, I think, allowed to feel a little bit like, at what point can we stop asking these questions and just go, what's it like being a comedian? What's it like being a footballer? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think you hit the nail on the head by saying it's the platform that's being given. But when we talk about the lionesses, at least, because now it would be like, if it's on, I wouldn't think anything of it.
No.
Whereas 10 years ago, I'd be like, oh, this is a bit unique.
Yeah. Well, I can remember being at
uni.
But it
wasn't unique, really.
No. I can remember being at uni and this advert coming on for the Women's World Cup. And I'm like being like, oh, my God, like, women's football is being shown on like the mainstream channels. And I didn't know who any of the players were, but I could name every player in probably the Premier League. Do you know what I mean? Like, not just like my club, like, well, my club wasn't in the Premier League at that point, but it's mad. And it is a fantastic time for women's football. And I hope that it kind of follows what I feel has happened with the comedy circuit of like, it's now embarrassing if you're not platforming women in that way.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the same with the channels now and commercial brands. If you're only going with men's football, it's embarrassing on your part.
Yeah. Kerry said the reason why Taskmaster's been so great is like a human tapas.
Yeah.
I thought that's it.
That's it. That's so what every good. Lineup should be. It should be human tapas.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
But what about
rather
actually
than just gammon? Sorry, I couldn't resist.
What about the experiences with the lionesses then? Because that must have been pretty special to be like in the sort of facilities, the training centre, and actually getting to sort of see them doing their work behind the scenes and actually be a part of it.
Yeah, I felt like I'd won a competition, genuinely. Like, because football's always been such a huge part of my life, but the lionesses specifically, what they've done...
European champions.
Yeah, and what that did, that specific victory did in terms of elevating the profile of the women's game, in terms of, you know, people always talk about what it did for women and young girls, and that's important and it's valid, but it wasn't just women and young girls. That's what's so important about it, is it caught the attention of everybody and invited everybody to feel part of it. And I think that's such an achievement in football, because football... I love it. I adore it. But it's got a really nasty side. When we're talking about, you know, the men's game and what is... And that's up until...
Fan behaviour.
You know, the last five, that's been what I've been taking in as football. But fan behaviour, you know, violence at games, the abuse at players, racism, homophobia, sexism, they're all ingrained in this game. and the Lionesses brought to the nation's attention a game that doesn't involve any of that, that is inclusive of everybody, has a very positive atmosphere, has these players that feel approachable. And what was so great about this campaign is it was like everyone was meeting each other. It felt kind of like for the first time. Mm. So we came up through with them on their journey to broader success. It felt like we were kind of coming along with them for the ride. And so I absolutely adore them for the level of sport that they play. Is you know, that they are the best in the world, I believe. But also that the people that they are off the pitch is hugely, hugely inspiring, and is doing absolute wonders for the progression of the game. The whole game, not the women's game. They play football the way football should be for everybody. And when you see, you know, we went to three of the games at the Euros and we go to the Brighton women's games here. When you go to those atmospheres, it's completely different. No one's picking up bad habits at 5 or 6 years old from going to a women's football game. They're just picking up great vibes and being inspired by brilliant players. It's only a positive thing. So in many ways, I hope it doesn't catch up to the men's level. I hope it overtakes and dictates what football is.
Set an example.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the training like specifically?
Oh, I still have a pain in this bit of my hand from a goalkeeping exercise we did with Mary Earps, Ellie Roebuck and Hannah Hampton with the help of Carly Telford, where they were like showing us how to be goalkeepers. And I thought they'd be booting it at us. They had a ball launcher, which was, I've only ever seen used in like baseball. But it was like a bigger version of it. And they did it with Catherine. And I think Catherine would say this herself, which was pretty hopeless.
When I saw in the first advert for the show, I was thinking, I can't really picture Catherine Ryan as a footballer. I can see her as a great coach.
Oh,
great motivator.
Yeah, this is the conclusion we came to. She would be an unbelievable manager. You know, when you see Pep go like a bit psycho.
It instills a fear in you.
Yeah,
you feel like I've got to run through.
She could do that. In fact, we spoke to Emma Hayes after the FA Cup final. Yeah, and she and Catherine have a very similar no bullshit energy.
Straight talk.
Yeah, yeah. Emma Hayes how she became a manager, and she was like, "Well, I was already doing all the fucking jobs anyway. I drove the bus. I got the kit." She was like, "We were like, oh, okay. Might have to clear a few of those words." But her and Catherine are very, very similar, actually. So she'd be a brilliant manager, but I think she'd concede herself that she was pretty hopeless in goal. But they did it. They did this ball launcher at Catherine, and it was like 40 miles an hour or something. And then they put me in goal. Mary Earps just sort of got this red mist across her. She was like, right, 70 miles per hour. Jeez. And it shot it. And also, because I'm such a fan of them, I so want to impress them. So there was no bit of me that was like, well, can I start on 40 miles an hour? Instead, I was like, yep, bring it. And it shot it at me. And I tried to save it. And I did. And I was delighted about it. And then after a few hours, it really set in that I think I've broken something in my hand. And it's still... It's still really dodgy. I'm currently trying to write all my thank you letters for the wedding, and I'm sort of having to write like that, or dictate it to Mike like a sort of well-off novel writer.
It is sort of like a badge of honour, though, right?
Oh, yeah. If you're going to get an injury, you want it from...
How do you do that?
FIFA's best goalkeeper, Mary Earps, shooting a cannon of footballs at me at 70 miles per hour. It's much better than, I slammed it in the cupboard, isn't it?
Yeah. So much better.
Yeah.
Having that sort of meteoric sort of rise in comedy, and you mentioned the DVDs and the list of, you know, the Peter Kays and so on. Did you ever get to an occasion where you met somebody and you were quite starstruck?
Yeah. It still happens. It still happens now. But I would say that there was one in comedy, which was Lee Mack, because I can remember getting a present for my 14th birthday was my mum and dad taking me to Sheffield Town Hall to see him. And I thought it was one of the best shows I'd ever seen. And I found him so funny, and I had his DVDs. And then I was on Would I Lie to You?
I love that show.
And I was sat next to him, and I was really quite nervous. And, you know, there's always this thing of, like, don't meet your heroes. And he was exactly how he is on the telly, on DVDs and all of this. And he was so so giving and so kind and making sure that, you know, you as the new kid on the block get enough to say. And then also when the camera stopped, it's a lot of checking in on you and nice, you know, taking an interest in where you're from and what you do. And the whole time you're talking to him, you're just thinking, I can't believe that when I was 14, like, I went, you know, I was like absolutely stoked going all the way to Sheffield to see you. And here I am working with you. And over the years, I've worked with Lee loads. And most recently, Soccer Aid, where like we hung out all weekend over the training. And he's like, he's a mate now. That's what blows my mind, is when it goes from like comedy hero to then meeting them.
And such distance.
Being star, yeah, such distance. And then that's that distance suddenly goes like that and it's a bit starstruck. And then it suddenly sort of plateaus out into you're a colleague or a mate. It's really weird that I'm mates with some of the people who I used to travel right across Yorkshire to go and see, or would, you know, ask for their work for Christmas, you know.
I completely get that.
It's really strange. Yeah. Jason Manford, another one. I can remember watching him when 8 out of 10 Cats first came out onto the scene. He was that team captain. I just thought he was so funny. And then I spent most of last year being tour support for him. It's cliche to say, but I pinch myself every day that I managed to make this my career, because it means I have interactions like that.
Yeah.
Like, it blows my mind.
Or be on a podcast and talk about your life.
Yeah. I mean, that's weird. This is weird. It's like, I remember when I got the email through for this and I was like, oh, plot twist. Okay. You just, well, we just talk about me. Okay.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I was like, oh, it feels quite.
Okay. Let me ask you a plot twist. Person, okay.
Plot twist person question.
Yeah, so we've spoken about Mrs. Bray.
Yes.
But is there a plot twist person that has been a surprise entity, a surprise force in inspiring you or giving you an opportunity that you wouldn't have foreseen?
I think it probably would be Karen and Katie Corran, who run the Gilded Balloon up at Edinburgh. And they have done for you. And, you know, we've spoken already about women in comedy. But that is worth mentioning of Karen, so Katie is Karen's daughter. But Karen Corran has run the Gilded Balloon for decades. And that would have been at a time where every other person, especially running gigs, was a bloke. So Karen is Karen is in the category of Catherine Ryan and Emma Hayes in terms of...
Let's tell it like it is.
Yeah, no bullshit. Who strike that balance of being very lovely people, but don't take any shit. And that can get misconstrued, mainly by men, in all of the respective industries, as being intimidating or too much or bossy. But Karen is a real force, I think. And she's been at the helm of the Gilded Balloon.
Is that sort of a comedy club, essentially?
Yeah, comedy club, business, venue. They've promoted acts over the years. They've represented acts. But I would say, yeah, mainly hosted acts as a comedy venue. They're one of the big venues at the Edinburgh Fringe. But sort of do stuff year-round, mainly in Scotland. But to set up the Gilded Balloon all those years ago and run it, Karen, as herself, you know, single mum, running it herself, working alongside all of these people in comedy, often being the only woman in the room, is incredible. But they were very, very good early on in my career, because I'd won So You Think You're Funny. I was sort of under there. So the prize is £2,500. They flew me out to Montreal for the Just for Laughs festival, which was insane. And
that's pretty insane.
I got my first, you know, the prize was also that your first comedy show at the Edinburgh Festival would be done under Gilded Balloon's care. And there was never a point with Karen or Katie where, having won So You Think You're Funny and preparing to do my first show, any question was fine asking them. They were very, like, accommodating of any needs that I needed sort of with my show. They were very good with advice. They were very good with just sort of checking in on you as a person, which I think is very important in any form of like entertainment industry, because it's sort of like you're asked to sort of just turn up and be on all the time, which is great and I love it, but it's really nice when you feel like that the people who have booked you to perform are also just vested, they have a vested interest in you as a person, your welfare, that you're having a good festival, that you're having a nice time, that you're happy with what is happening.
Contributes to the whole experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if you speak to any comedian and bring up the words the Edinburgh Fringe, it's a mixture of feelings because it's a bubble of comedy and all of the lovely things that come with that. But it's also, it's a bit like what I was saying about drama school. It's a intense bubble of everybody. Yeah, there's a lot of cliques, there's a lot of egos, and there's a lot of, even without that, there's a lot of unconscious comparison. And Karen and Katie were very, very good of keeping me sort of cool, calm, collected, not getting too injected into the bubble of Edinburgh, and just very, very supportive, both before that month, after that month, and ever since, really. Ever since, like, if there's anything that they can help with, they're very on it. I think them, and then also, it feels predictable to say your agent, but it's true. Again, after So You Think You're Funny, there was lots of people putting business cards in my hand and going, let's have a chat. And I went for a chat with, you know, all of them. I went for tea with one, and they were like, what we love about you is the northern working class element, and we'd really like you to ham that up. And I was like, and it happens a lot. People hear this accent and immediately think you're from a terraced house with an outside toilet, which is fine if you are, but it's a very generalised stereotype to hear a northern accent and immediately assume working class. The same way that there's a lot of comedians from London who are working class, but, you know, the industry would perceive them as, well, they won't be. Whereas me, I'm a female Billy Elliot, of course. So that was frustrating, of that like assumption that and that you're going to ham it up, which feels very disingenuous.
Did they also, because when you first said that, I envisaged somebody almost like selling you the stars and saying, we're going to do this, you're going to
There was a lot of that, of like, what we'd do is we'd have you this way, we'd have you that way, you know, we'd get you doing this, which I get is important, and it's a good way of
selling it,
of showing to me that you've got a plan. But I went for a cup of tea with my agent, wasn't my agent at the time, but went for a cup of tea with Claire. And I sat down and I remember just going, I mean, first of all, lots of the other agents would take me to like these, I guess what they'd call fancy, but I'd call wanky, like private members clubs, you know what I mean? And having a rooftop drink or whatever. And I feel a bit uncomfortable. Even now, I hate it when there's a meeting in a private members club. I don't get why. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's lots of lovely cafes. Let's just go there. And I went for a cup of tea with Claire, and she just sat me down, asked how I was. Like, we're just, you know, we're having a normal chat first. And then it was like, what do you want? What would you like in this career? What would be your dreams and aspirations? And she was like, there's no wrong answer. There's no silly answers. And so, you know, I started with the sort of smaller things of what I'd like. And then I felt like it was a very safe space to go, and I dream of this, go and big. I dream of that. I feel like she gets me as a comedian, but, and, you know, knows, I have no idea how that side of stuff works. She does it, but the business side, great. But I think it's also worth mentioning, and I've spoken about this in my first ever show, but so I'm epileptic, and there's loads of different types of epilepsy. And a lot of the time people think, oh, it's flashing lights. It's not. For me, it's to do with sleep. So, yeah, so I can go on a right good old night out and call it, you know, come in at 4 or 5 a.m., fine. I just can't be then up at 8 o'clock the next morning because I'd have a seizure. I need a good night's sleep.
How many hours are we talking?
Ideally, 7 minimum.
Yeah.
So 6 would be fine, but I'd be, you know, I wouldn't want to be getting up and doing soccer aid the next day.
I was going to say, that could have been an interesting situation.
Well, no, exactly, but when you think that comedy is an industry where you're gigging till late at night, you know, I'm doing a gig tomorrow night and I've already checked and I won't get back till 1 a.m. here in Brighton. Claire will know that, and she'll know that if you'd messaged Claire and said, can we do this briefing call? Can we do this podcast at 9 a.m? Without even having to come and ask and tell me. Like, I told her like once, basically, this is how my epilepsy works. And she's just completely
on board.
Yeah, she's brilliant with it. So she wouldn't even come back to me going, you've had this offer. but they want to do now. She'd just go back and say, it's going to need to be later. She's really understanding of it. If anything, she goes into a mum role sometimes and she's like, you've got that briefing call on, you know, or you've got this happening. The car's coming for you at 9 a.m. so make sure you get an early night.
It makes such a difference, though.
It does, it does. And
business is ruthless.
I think there's an importance to having people in the industry like Claire and like the Corrans who are in it for the right reasons because they love comedy and they know that comedy works best when people are at their best.
Mm. Something's come into my mind that wasn't on the notes, but Mount Rushmore of comedy.
Yeah.
Who would be on your top four?
Okay. Victoria Wood straight in there.
Legend.
Like absolute icon. Legend. Mm. Absolute legend.
Trailblazer, icon, all the...
So witty. I'm going to put Peter Kay there because I love...
Oh,
I love
Phoenix
the way
Nights
he
was...
makes... Yeah, and I love the way he makes... Growing up... It felt like he was reflecting everybody's experience. It felt like when he's talking about, you know, his mum or a lot of his family characters, you recognise them in your own family. So I'd have Victoria Wood, Peter Kay.
It's a strong start.
Rick Mayall. I find Rick Mayall brilliant. So funny. Me and my brother used to watch Bottom all the time. We had the DVDs when we were on holiday. We'd watch the DVDs of Bottom on an evening. Just loved it. Found it so funny. And his faces that he did.
I was just going to say, he's one of those gifted comedians, a bit like someone like a Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey, like facially, Lee Evans, those like
just
physical.
Had that physical comedy.
So
that
funny.
Not everyone can do that.
So funny. There's a video, I don't know what it's from, and it's only about 10 seconds long. I think you can see it on YouTube. And it's Rick Mayall, and he's listening to somebody speak.
Yes.
At a wedding. Have you seen it?
Yeah. He sees the camera.
Yeah, and he clocks that there's a camera looking at him. He's got that thing that essentially comedians all are of they can't...
Mischief.
They can't resist being the centre of attention, though, as well. And if they see a camera, they're like, oh, God, here we go. Like, and my I've got an uncle in my family, Uncle Richard, who's sort of got a very similar personality of, like, he'll do anything for a laugh. And he's very funny and he's very physical. And there was a time where we were all on this family holiday in Dublin and we were in one of these Irish bars where there was a big performance space for when the band were about to come on. There'd been some Irish dancing and the band was going to come on. They had about, you know, half an hour in between. And Richard had gone to the loo. But to get back to us, he had to walk across this stage. And you just knew there was no way Uncle Richard was going to be able to walk across that stage without... doing his best Michael Flatley impression. Like, and it's that same trait of like, there's no way Rick Mayall can clock that there's a camera on him and not doing his little faces. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Victoria Wood, Peter Kay, Rick Mayall. And I'm going to put Colin Holt on there, who's down here in Brighton as well. But Colin Holt has done for years. I don't know if he's putting it to bed because his show recently was as if he's ending the character. But he's done this character, Anna Mann, for years. He's sort of like a failed actress. And it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And this show, it was nominated at the Edinburgh Fringe. I saw it with a friend up at the Edinburgh Fringe when I was there last year. And then it was on tour and I took Mike to see it. And it was just... You know, when you just spend an hour literally bent double with that bit of your ribs hurting.
Yes.
When you laugh so hard and you're just trying to breathe in because you've just laughed for ages.
Yeah.
It was that for an hour. I feel really lucky to be on the circuit at the same time as an act as good as Colin Holt's Anna Mann. And I really hope he's not putting that character to bed because it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Keep it going.
Colin, if you're listening, please keep it going.
That's a solid four. That's a solid four.
Yeah, it's really good.
I said earlier on, you're known for your football.
This is, you know, that question people ask of like, you're having a dinner party, who would you have round? That was it as well. Like at Soccer Aid, there was a bit, right, this is an insane sentence, right? So we turn up at Champneys in Tring, which is where the training is, and you check in and then they're like, right, if you go through to the restaurant, we're all going to have lunch together. So go to the buffet and get on a table.
Also, just to clarify, is this the first time you'd met everyone?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay. So no training beforehand.
No. So a car picks me up, drops me outside the main entrance. There's cameras sort of, you know, and you're doing, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm really excited. Now walk in, check in, and it's all with somebody with you, being like, you know, making sure everything worked. And then they're like, right, if you just go through to the restaurant, whatever, you know, everyone's arriving, and then we'll do a briefing. So I went in, and it literally felt like first day of school, because I went in, grab a plate, and you're loading it up. And Mo Farah was at the buffet as well. And he's like, you know, eating like three green beans and, you know, like all the stuff you're meant to eat. I don't know, white fish.
He loves his corn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's probably wasn't eating any meat. But it was very good, whereas I was like, I'm starving. Here we go, free food. Very comedian. But there was loads of tables, but one was filling up and it only had one seat free on it. And it was me and Mo Farah putting our food on. And I was a little bit like, oh, what if Mo goes and sits on there and then I've got to sit on my own? You know, all these like things,
yeah,
like,
of course,
like,
yeah,
a new,
yeah,
kid at school. And so sort of in advance. And I'd met Mo before. We'd done fantasy football together. But it was, again, one of those moments where you're like, I can't believe I'm just loading up my plate next to Olympic champion Mo Farah, national treasure Sir Mo Farah. And I just said to him, I was like, I think I said, can I sit with you, Mo? And he was like, yeah, yeah, let's sit over here. So we sort of set up a new table. And then Emma Hayes turned up and she was like, all right, Mo. And like, she sits down there. She's like, you're right, I am, Emma. Nice to meet you. And Vicky McClure from This Is England, Line of Duty, Trigger Point fame, absolute iconic actress. She turns up and she's, and I'm like looking at this table and I'm like,
yeah,
Emma Hayes, Vicky McClure and Mo Farah would not be a dinner party I'd ever turned down, nor would had ever envisioned myself having. So it was mad, just sort of like sitting there. I was like trying to eat this chicken wing, being like, and trying not to just keep looking up, being like, I can't believe I'm sat here. It was mad. Absolutely mad. Absolutely mad. Yeah.
That's, yeah. Pretty
blows my mind. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
I've Thanks loved chatting me. Away.
Thank you. It's been really good fun. It's weird how you like think of the little moments in your life. It's been good fun.
Is there anything coming up we should know about? Anything that you want to...
The Lioness Show is pretty good. The World Cup will be
amazing.
Check
that out for sure. Definitely.
I won't be playing in the World Cup, sadly.
Injury.
Maybe next time.
Maybe next
time.
Yeah,
it's injury. Yeah.
Injury related.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Serena asked, but, you know.
One of those things.
I had this.
Yeah. God. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
I love that chat. I may sound like a broken record every week saying that, but I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that. She was brilliant. She was down to earth. She was honest. And actually, it was really inspiring hearing her story. And when in doubt, just bring chocolate orange into the equation. It really helps. I was thinking, actually, how many people like chocolate orange? I reckon 60%. I'm very much in that group, with Maisie, of course. Anyway, back to the conversation. Do you know what? When we were talking about a plot twist, obviously going through drama school, and then that pathway to comedy, writing down those jokes and gags on the back of a receipt and storing those away and building those up to that first gig, I couldn't help just feeling sort of inspired, really, because so sort of there was a slightly tenacious, really ambitious, and just this sort of attitude of, do you know what, let's just give it a go. And of course, as I said in the intro, and obviously we spoke about quite at length in the interview itself, this journey to Fringe, but how quickly that all arrived. And maybe that was a good thing because there wasn't time to think. It was just, let's just get on and do it. But clearly had this passion and my goodness, it's paid off. It was genuinely fascinating to hear that side of the story. Obviously we spoke about women in sport and women in comedy. And that was a conversation that I had with Kerry last week. I don't really want to add too much to it because I think she put it perfectly. And actually what she said about a platform, that's what there is now. With the Lionesses, for example, compared to maybe 10 years ago, and it is growing and it's brilliant. And speaking of the Lionesses, A League of Their Own special with Maisie Adam, Catherine Ryan, and new team captain Jill Scott. Go and check it out. It's brilliant. They spend time with the Lionesses, understanding the behind the scenes of these brilliant professional athletes, and there's plenty of laughs along the way. Honestly, you do not want to miss it. It's available on Sky Max and now. Go and check it out. There'll be plenty of other opportunities to see Maisie. She's doing lots of gigs over the summer and going into autumn. go and check them out on ticketing websites. And in the meantime, I'm going to have some chocolate orange. And will the plot twist comedy tour continue next week? Well, you'll have to find out. I'll see you then.